The matter of Kenneth James Rossellini. Can we please have appearances?
Isabel McGinty, Assistant Ethics Counsel, Office of Attorney Ethics.
Good afternoon. Kenneth Rossellini, attorney at law, appearing pro se.
McGinty, please.
May it please the court. This matter is before the court following from the decision of the Disciplinary Review Board, finding that the respondent had violated two rules of professional conduct arising out of his failure to have complied with the terms of multiple court orders that were issued by New Jersey courts in a family court matter in which he had served as counsel for one of the parties. Now, the RPCs at issue are 3.4C, which provides that, quote, a lawyer shall not knowingly disobey an obligation under the rules of a tribunal except for an open refusal based on an assertion that no valid obligation exists. And that RPC addresses the obligation of every attorney to comply with orders of the court. And respondent asserts here that he had the right openly to refuse to obey any of the orders, with his refusal continuing to this day. And based on his unilateral objection that he regarded the issuing courts as having exceeded their authority. And the second RPC at issue is 8.4D, which is conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. So the court orders had been issued in family court litigation, whose extensive procedural history that I won't go into here is laid out in the decision of the Disciplinary Review Board, and that's at pages 2 to 11. But that family court matter had commenced as a divorce case initially filed in 1998. And the respondent entered the matter as successor counsel for the former wife in that litigation in 2016, so 18 years into the litigation. The court orders that are at issue start in 2016, specific to the respondent. And I'm going to get to them very, very briefly. So the first is June 10th, 2016, issued by the Chancery Division, specifying that the respondent is to pay a set amount of money, which is $5,000 plus, by a set date, which is 10 days, within 10 days of the entry of the order. So the order is filed on June 10th, 2016. So that order then was to have been complied with in June of 2016. So we're now 6 years past that order. Two more orders then, same litigation, but the respondent applies to the appellate division, where there were two orders then that were issued by the appellate division in August and September of 2017. Again, this is a specific amount that's set in each of those orders. It's $2,000 payable within 14 days of the entry of that order, plus for each of the two orders, $200 in court costs. There's an additional order then that is issued by this court. The 2017 orders were over 5 years past the dates when those orders were to have been complied with. This court issued an order in the matter, and there's a question in the DRB decision as to why this was not part of the District Ethics Committee investigation in the matter. And it may be a matter of timing, probably is a matter of timing. This court issued its order on January 11th, 2019, 1 week earlier, January 4th, 2019, that's when the grievance to the District Ethics Committee complaining that the respondent had not complied with the terms of the orders. So the order of this court was then issued January 11, 2019, and that imposed on the respondent an additional $5,000 in counsel fees and costs, which he was then directed to pay. So as of January 11, 2019, the total amount that had been assessed against the respondent was $14,087.50 plus $400 in court costs. Now, there can't be any question in this matter that the respondent is aware of all four orders because he has discussed them in the briefs that he has submitted, including most recently, December 13, 2022. This is from page 38, where the respondent submitted his position, his continuing position with regard to the orders. And this is a quote, petitioner has refused to comply with the terms of the Supreme Court order and has not paid any attorney fees required by the subject orders and openly asserted that no valid obligation exists. Now, in this matter, volunteer members of the District 11 Ethics Committee in Passaic County conducted the investigation. They issued the disciplinary complaint, and the matter proceeded to a hearing before the DEC hearing panel consisting of two volunteer attorney members and one volunteer public member. The two attorney members following from that hearing, voted to dismiss. The public member disagreed and submitted a written dissent stressing the detrimental impact of a dismissal in these circumstances on the public perception of the integrity of the attorney ethics system. And the public member stated that he would have found the violation of the RPCs, and the public member recommended that a reprimand should be appropriate in this case. The Office of Attorney Ethics then filed an appeal of the District Ethics Committee's dismissal. That went to the DRB. The grievance separately appealed the dismissal, and then the DRB scheduled this for oral argument. So the issue presented is whether the respondent, in openly refusing to comply with the terms of the court orders, should be found to have violated RPCs 3.4C and 8.4D. So as far as what the DRB determined, so the DRB issued its decision on analyzing how the evidence supported the finding that the respondent had violated both of the RPCs. And five members of the board recommended imposition of a 3-month term of suspension, and four members recommended instead imposition of a censure. All members of the board included the requirement that the respondent comply with the terms of all of the court orders as a mandatory condition of the discipline imposed. And the OAE asked the court then to rule in accord with the DRB decision. First, as far as the analysis of the evidence, the RPCs at issue, their application, the violations, as well as the quantum of discipline that's recommended by the majority of the board on these facts. And there's a 2-sentence summary of this case that's given in the course of the lengthy DRB decision, but I'll just quote it briefly here. This is from page 41 of the DRB decision. Despite being rebuked by every court of this state and exhausting his legal remedies, respondent has, over the course of 5 years, refused to comply with 4 separate court orders and has failed to pay the sanctions imposed upon him. Respondent's misconduct clearly violates RPC 3.4C and 8.4D. I would ask the court also to recognize the importance that the DRB saw in the public member dissent at the district level in the hearing of this case, but it's also emphasized by the DRB as for the public member view on the board of this same matter. This is from page 56 of the DRB decision. We find compelling the dissenting public member's observation that respondent's misconduct demonstrates an inability to accept any decisions with which he disagrees. Moreover, we give great weight to the public member's opinion that respondent's refusal to comply with 3 court orders should not be tolerated merely because he is an attorney, because that is not a right afforded to members of the public whom the ethics system is charged with protecting. That position is echoed by our own public members. So there's an emphasis here on public member input at the district committee level and also in the disciplinary review board level. I would also ask the court to recognize the to endorse the analysis of RPC 3.4C, which is it laid out in the DRB decision, and this is at pages 41 to 45, because there may perhaps be a question presented on the part of the respondent as to some ambiguity as to how that RPC would apply in this matter. On page 46 of the decision, there's a 4-part test that the DRB had prescribed for matters such as these. And the first involved that there must be an open refusal to comply with an obligation under the rules of the tribunal. Second thing would be that the open refusal has to be based on an assertion that no valid obligation exists. Third would be that the attorney makes that assertion in good faith, from the subjective perception of that particular attorney. But fourth, that the assertion is objectively reasonable. It's an objectively reasonable attempt to test the legal validity of a valid obligation. The burden of proof by the DRB's analysis would be on the attorney asserting the application of those conditions. And the DRB notably had said that the lawyer cannot, as happened here, unilaterally and surreptitiously flout a court order. The lawyer shall be required to have either sought further appellate review or to comply with the court's order under protest. while preserving the issue for a subsequent appeal. Now, a failure to appeal or otherwise challenge the judgment shall reflect a lack of good faith, because a lack of a good faith belief that no obligation existed to comply with that judgment. The DRB went further, though, and said, to be clear, they were not adopting a new rule. Instead, what they were doing was articulating what a reasonable reading would be of the existing rule 3.4C. And in that spirit, the DRB said, they didn't hesitate to impose discipline and to find the violations in this particular matter. Pages 47 and 48 of the DRB decision go into why the board determined that there was not such a good faith belief on the part of the respondent in this matter, and included because there was a failure to request from the federal courts that the federal courts vacate the sanctions orders in the family court matter. The respondent hadn't asked for that from the New Jersey courts either. He'd waited 2 years after the receipt of the Supreme Court denial of a motion for reconsideration before taking any action at all, and he'd already exhausted all his procedural remedies before the New Jersey courts. So there can't be a good faith or an objectively reasonable belief that the orders are invalid or that he's not obligated to comply. And my understanding is, to this day, the respondent has not complied with any of the terms of those orders. With regard to the disciplinary analysis set forth in the DRB decision, and I had said that the DRB, five members of the DRB recommended 3 months suspension, and also including the requirement of compliance by the respondents with all the terms of the court orders. There's an analysis within the DRB decision of what aggravating factors are presented here. And what's unusual about this case is the number of court orders, and including one of the orders involves the sanctions order imposed by this court, and where many years passed when the court imposed those sanctions. And it's my expectation that the respondent, as he stands before you, is still not going to have complied with that order. So there's the issue of the continuing violation, which is certainly a significant aggravator. And the other is, and it's tied in with that, a lack of remorse or a recognition of a valid obligation to comply with the orders of the New Jersey courts, including the order of the Supreme Court. There are constitutional issues that have been raised by the respondent. These are addressed by the DRB at length in its opinion, pages 48 to 54. There was a motion with, there were some papers that I got on Friday evening by email, which if the court seeks to have any kind of response on that, I would expect that the court would be setting a schedule on that. I'm not prepared to address those here now. With regard to what's before the court, it is that issue of the continuing violation and how the court in this particular case addresses it. And unless the court has any questions, I would submit on that.
What is your view on the import of the litigation in federal court?
It should not have an impact on the present proceedings. Certainly, the hearing panel in the district had determined that there should this matter should not proceed until the respondent had his opportunity fully to go through such proceedings. So I've been checking the docket in both the federal in both the District of New Jersey as well as in the Third Circuit, and there is certainly an issue that's addressed. I believe it's in a footnote in the DRB decision that there is immunity of participants in the ethics system, those members of the DECs, against having to defend in court in relation to their work on the committees. And that has certainly been tested here by the respondent. There are members of the judiciary who are defendants in that matter. The respondent has asserted a First Amendment right and other constitutional basis for his right to test out the validity of the court orders at issue. And certainly the courts would in most circumstances not deter or detract in any way from the ability of a respondent to do that. It would be for the court to determine in these unique circumstances, you know, given that the federal complaint was filed after the hearing and while the panel was deliberating on its decision. Named in that decision are any of the judges who had ruled in these particular matters, the chair of the hearing panel, the district ethics committee, the presenter in this case. Included among the judges who had issued the orders was the Chief Justice himself. That certainly these are unique and rather extreme circumstances. As for how the court would deal with that in this particular case, it would certainly seem to have some significance, and certainly some significance as to the notice to the respondent at this point, when it seems that based on the orders that are presently in place, because the motion for reconsideration in the federal district court has been denied, the defendant in that matter, Dr. Doblin, had filed also a motion to vacate the default that had been entered against him. That has been vacated. So it seems that in the federal district matter, as I read the docket, there is nothing presently going forward or likely to go forward as to any of the members of the court or of the district ethics committees who were named as defendants in those matters. So those matters appear to be resolved. Certainly as to the issue of, is the respondent on notice, all the more now, that there's an obligation for him to pay and that the money is due. Certainly there is, but he still has not paid.
Questions, anyone?
I'm a little confused, Ms. McGinty, about the status of the federal matter and the relief sought. Let's start with the relief sought. Is there any injunctive relief sought to restrain the imposition of discipline on the respondent?
There are allegations. My understanding is no. There are allegations that were raised as to the ethics system in New Jersey, but in particular with regard to the district court docket. So docket entry number 49, it's a motion for reconsideration of the court's October 2021 order, which had resolved the issues as to the state defendants. That motion for reconsideration was denied as of May 31st, 2022. And that original order from which the respondent had sought reconsideration had granted the Judiciary and Ethics Committee defendants' motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction as to various counts of the complaint. There's a separate order, and it's docket entries 59 and 60, and this from the district court, that granted Dr. Doblin's motion to vacate the default and has separately denied the plaintiff's motion to partially vacate the orders.
So the dismissal did not resolve the entire federal case?
No, and there is a letter filed by the Attorney General representing the various defendants asking the district court, is there any need for anything to be submitted in that case, in part because of the confusion of the dockets and the number of motions that the respondent has filed. There is also presently pending, is still pending, an appeal of some of the decisions of the federal district court that's pending before the Third Circuit. And that, I believe there's been no change in that since September of 2022.
But you have a district court docket that shows there are some parties left in it, or the Doblin aspect of it is still going?
Yes. And there was a granting of a motion on the part of the respondent for him to file an amended complaint, but that has not happened as to any of the state defendants.
He has not filed an amended complaint. He had leave to do
so? As to the state defendants.
But did the district court grant the respondent leave to file an amended complaint against the state defendants?
No.
So what is pending there? Just the claims against the private parties?
Yes. And because of the default, somewhat complicated by the default.
Is there anything that is, it's hard for, I know you're reading a docket, and sometimes it's difficult to decipher exactly what's going on, but is there anything left for the district court to decide?
So the respondent had filed an appeal with the Third Circuit.
Appeal as a right to the Third Circuit?
Well, as for the denial of motion for reconsideration. So there is, and it's extremely confusing from the docket, You know, to the extent that the DAG handling the matter had written to the district court some months back asking, is there a need for us to do something in this particular case? And on the Third Circuit docket, the last entry is for the respondent to have submitted the explanation of the statement of the case explaining the various procedural aspects. I would note that the respondent has rather aggressively and creatively filed motions and causes of action. And each of those cases is pending, still an open status before the district court as well as before the Third Circuit.
So he's filed new claims?
No.
He's filed what?
The respondent had moved for and this is based on my reading of the pleadings in that particular case. So the respondent had appealed or had sought reconsideration of decisions of the court which had dismissed the case as to the state defendants. So the respondent...
I think you said it was denied, right?
It was denied, yes. So that
should be done.
So the respondent had sought reconsideration and has also, as I understand it, as I read it, has also sought relief from the Third Circuit as to those decisions as well.
He's filed interlocutory appeals to the Third Circuit on those motions.
Yes.
For leave to appeal.
Yes.
Well, the claims against the state defendants dismissed, if you could tell, with or without prejudice?
I'm looking at my notes because I believe I had noted it. So, original order, October 14th, 2021, granted Judiciary and the Ethics Committee defendants' motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction as to two of the counts without prejudice, but with regard to two of the other counts with prejudice. And there's a number of defendants, and there's a number of claims as to each of them. Some of them are personally associated, and some of it because of position.
If we were to ask you to submit a letter trying to parse out what you can gather, would you be able to do so?
I would be much more comfortable doing that, yes.
Let's try that approach perhaps instead then.
Right.
Very well. And
thank
I know
you.
I started this line of questioning. I'm not thinking so.
But I continued it.
Well, I've read through the docket, but it's not easy to parse, and I'm interpreting on it. So,
yes,
I would prefer to do it right.
Other questions? Anyone? Thank you, Ms. McGinty. Mr. Rossellini.
May it please the court. I am the pro se respondent, Kenneth Rossellini. I'm submitting before the court that the matter before the court should be dismissed at this time without prejudice, as the recommendation was from the local committee for the reasons that were set forth in that opinion, which is that I should be allowed, as most respondents are in ethics matters in the state of New Jersey, when there's pending litigation that could affect the outcome of the ethics matter, that the attorney should be allowed to participate and continue in that litigation until it is completed and not suffer from the oversight and in the investigation of an ethics committee, which is not really, again, investigating an ethics issue, but acting in a matter of leverage in a litigation which is ongoing. Quite frankly, I had prepared a statement, an uninterrupted statement, as I had indicated, for 5 minutes, but I think I should kind of immediately deviate from that because I'd rather spend my time answering the questions that the court addressed than my allegations as they concern the ethics matter and the orders in the court. I think it's significant that, based on the presentation by the Office of Attorney Ethics, this court and anybody watching this would not have any idea what the issues were that these orders that I'm contesting, that they involved assertions of serious fraud upon the court and the family court matter, the opinions and the disciplinary review board decision, and that are referenced by the Office of Attorney Ethics mentioned none of it, that there was a court proceeding in the state of New Jersey, the Superior Court in Bergen County, in which a consent order was purportedly entered on the record that involved a handwritten settlement agreement in which my client, Linda Doblin, who's now deceased, passed away in August of this year, still asserting that her rights had been violated, and with the belief that the family court system was just so overwhelmed and and was susceptible to the fraud in the court that had been committed by both the ex-husband, ex-spouse, Dr. Doblin, and the attorney, Frank LaRocca, Esquire, upon the court in conjunction with the court system, that that matter was ultimately resolved. And she actually had a pro se application pending, but she was not able to get heard before the family court because she was having difficulty both as a hearing disabled individual who had relied on a hearing aid and the fact that she was not able to operate the Zoom equipment. And the hearing was adjourned until she passed away. There's still...
Can I ask you to clarify some things about this underlying proceeding?
Yes, Your Honor.
The settlement agreement is struck on December 12th of 2006.
Yes, Your Honor.
And your client was asked on the record, is that your signature?
No, she was not.
No?
Actually, it's very clear, and this is a very important point, that every time that there's a representation made that this document and the settlement agreement was...
What happened then?
I'm sorry?
Tell us what happened then.
The settlement agreement was approved on the record, that we have... Here, what's leading into this proceeding in 2006 is that Linda Doblin is now completely, first of all, financially destitute. She has no more ability to pay attorney's fees. Her attorney's trying to withdraw. He's been ordered to stay on the case. There's an application pending to transfer custody and an additional application to help just to address alimony. So there's some kind of settlement conference in which my client doesn't have the real-time translation to negotiate with her attorney. And there's an agreement that's allegedly entered into that's handwritten, and this agreement includes all kinds of handwritten terms that are onerous. Linda Doblin, who never had any supervision before with her child, now was going to be supervised 24/7. Any time that she had visitation, the husband was going to be allowed to monitor and record it, and was going to be allowed to limit the visits to one time a week. So the settlement agreement that ultimately placed on the record completely relinquishes all her rights. She's still the parent, but she no longer has custody, so all these things are supervised. None of the terms are placed on the record. There's an indication that there's an exhibit J1, and my client, or Linda Doblin, was asked, is exhibit J1 what your agreement was? And she said, yes, under the circumstances. But in every previous order and settlement agreement, like any other voir dire, there would be the judge would ask the individual, well, item number one, it says this, do you agree to this? Item number two says this, do you agree to this? Instead, Judge Torak, the judge that presided over the case, indicated I take no position as to any of this. And even though this was a post-custody hearing, the change custody with change of circumstances, no finding that this was in the best interest of the child, no comment on any of the provisions, and not even asking a basic question, is that your signature on the page? That was not asked.
So I want to go through quickly with you what's on page 4 of the DRB's decision, and just ask you to tell us where you think they got it wrong.
Page 4 of the DRB decision?
Yes, the first full paragraph. During the December 12, 2006 Superior Court appearance, tell me when you have it.
During her appearance.
Let me just go through it one by one, and then I'd like you to please answer.
Okay, go ahead. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. Linda testified she recognized the handwritten settlement agreement. Do you dispute that?
Yes. Because there was an indication that the settlement agreement wasn't presented to her. It wasn't put in front of her. She didn't have an opportunity, didn't review it. There was a statement made by the judge and attorneys that there's an exhibit J1, a joint exhibit. Did you agree to the terms? And she said yes, under the circumstances. So she didn't wasn't provided and asked to review it. And said, is this your handwriting? Are these your initials? Is this your signature? None of those questions were asked. Not even the terms and the accuracy of what was in the document. Just that there's an exhibit J1 that's in the courtroom. Do you agree to it? And she says yes.
There's a little bit more than that. The second clause that she testified that she and her attorney had reviewed each provision. Is that inaccurate?
She testified that she had reviewed each provision with her attorney and that the provisions that she reviewed, she didn't have, that the court appointed the real-time translation. But again, there's no statement in the record as to what those provisions were. So it ultimately enters into the consent order. There's no chain of custody or anything to prove that what was in the alleged memorialization of this agreement was what she consented to or agreed to or was ultimately entered into the consent order.
Is there a transcript that underlies this paragraph?
Yes, I've included it as an exhibit in my case. I've included it.
Tell us the the reference page if you can.
Yes, Your Honor.
Question as you're looking is, did she say, I don't know what you're talking about, when she was asked and testified that she reviewed each provision?
The point is that they did not ask her for each provision. So they asked you, did you agree to Exhibit 1? She says yes under the circumstances. They didn't ask her a single question about any of the provisions. They didn't ask her, do you agree to give up custody of your child? Do you agree to waive a hearing? Any of the normal questions?
Did she say, I don't know what agreement you're referring to. I don't understand what you're referring to.
She only indicated that she understood she was agreeing to what was in J1. And J1 is missing from the court record, which is one of the reasons that I got involved in the case. Because they were, based on J1, there was a prosecution for interference with custody because her child, then over the age of 14, continuously ran away from Dr. Doblin, the father, alleging abuse, and she was then...
Let's hold for a sec. Is J1 in the record before us?
There are copies of what appeared to be a handwritten settlement agreement that was represented. There are different versions of it, and one of them is in the record, but again, nobody knows if that's the actual J1.
Is there one with initials?
There are initials that appear on the left side of the agreement, but again, she didn't testify that those are initials, and it's a copy. The original has gone missing, and nobody really knows if any of those provisions the initials next to her were copied or attached or replaced.
I'll come back to that. Let me just tick through the items, and I want you to please help us as best you can.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did she testify she believed the agreement was fair and equitable under the circumstances?
She said that, yes, but again, she there was no statement as to what she thought she was agreeing to. So,
did she testify that she waived her right to a plenary hearing?
Yes, I believe she did. I believe she testified.
Did she testify that she chose to enter into the agreement in lieu of a trial?
Yes.
Now, there's a document that purportedly has initials, not a signature, initials of the parties and their respective counsel. Have you seen such a document?
Yes, Your Honor. And again, I reviewed it. I reviewed it in conjunction with every other document that was submitted in this case, in which the parties had signed either certifications or consent orders, which in fact had been done before, and the signature that purportedly is hers, and quite frankly, even the signatures of the attorneys, bear no relationship to any previous signature that she had ever submitted.
So these are initials in this document? Did you review it to documents that only had signatures or initials?
The documents had signatures at the end, and they also did. There were also what appeared to be initials in the left-hand column.
Did you get a handwriting assessment?
I did not retain a handwriting assessor, but one of the reasons certainly is that there was no original copy to compare anything to, because the documents had gone missing from the record.
Did you speak to the attorney who initialed the document?
I did not speak to my client's former attorney. I raised the issue again in the court proceeding on the motion.
So I want to know about your good faith basis for continuing to challenge this. You never talked to the lawyer whose initials appear beside initials that purport to be your client's and said, what happened here? Are these your initials?
I never spoke to the attorney. My client was asserting that this document was fraudulent and that the terms were onerous and they're not what she agreed to. And she had asked me not to speak. And that's one of the issues in the case. I'm both representing my client and trying to abide by her wishes, because I'm acting as her attorney. And she, at the time, didn't want me to reach out to that attorney and speak to him, and I didn't.
So till this day, your basis for pursuing this entire matter and not following through with the orders in this case have been, one, your client said this is fraudulent, and two, you did your own comparison of a signature to the initials, and you thought they didn't match up?
I did a comparison of the signatures and to the initials, and I have an understanding of what happened in those proceedings, which is that you have a document that is missing from the record. The terms are completely onerous. They're unconstitutional. They're unconscionable. This led to my client being unlawfully prosecuted for interference with custody. This child ended up being sent to a Scientology indoctrination camp in New Mexico, which was a clear violation of interference of custody of my client. That there was no sanction for that. There was no interview of a child all the way up until the age he was 17, who was constantly asserting that he was abused. There are things that happened in the court proceeding that indicate that there was a serious fraud, that my client's rights were denied. And it's not simply a matter, it's clear and obvious to anybody assessing and looking at the signatures, they don't remotely look alike. It's not like I took an assessment and said, well, this signature looks a little different. They're completely different, and they're in the exhibit list, and I brought it with me, and for some reason I can't find it. But there's an exhibit list in the case. I've also attached that as an exhibit to my federal complaint, which is still pending as well. We have different versions of a handwritten agreement. That again, when the criminal action was brought against my client for interference with custody, and the provision was brought before the grand jury, indicating, well, is this is one of the grand juries asked the prosecutor, well, is the child running away based on an assertion of abuse? And the prosecutor said, well, that issue is not before you, which was completely improper, and that was an absolute defense at the time. But when the case went before the criminal justice proceeding, they said, well, let's look at this document that purportedly changed custody. And when they tried to locate it in the court record and they weren't able to locate it, the court determined that the matter should be dismissed, that there was allegations and concerns about fraud.
Where can we find the transcript of the proceeding that's referenced on page 4 of the DRP decision?
It's both. I have a list of exhibits that I submitted in connection with this proceeding, and it's also a document that's attached to my complaint that's clearly marked as the transcript of the consent hearing, consent order hearing from that date.
Ms. McGinty, if we call on you later, can you tell us where to find those items?
I missed the first thing that you said, Chief Justice.
Can you tell us where to find those two items, the transcript and the agreement? Later?
Yes, I can. Later.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank
Let's
you.
Please go ahead with your argument then, counsel.
Now, with respect to the issue of the what's pending in federal court, is that I've sought an action based completely on injunctive and declaratory relief against both the ethics committee members and the various judges that made opinions in this case. And the issue being that when I filed my application and motion before the court, I only filed one motion. What I believe, and the case law is pretty clear, it's the constitutional duty of the court to both. Both review. Okay, actually, I've just finally found the list of orders. So it's Exhibit F and Exhibit G, and that I had submitted in the ethics proceeding. Exhibit G is the settlement, the transcript. Exhibit F is a copy of the orders, letters that I assert that were based on the forged signatures. So that both includes the transcript of the December 12, 2016 proceeding, and and some of various documents, including. Also, I submitted as Exhibit E a certification of Linda Dolman asserting that the signature was fraudulent, and her signature as it appears on that document. So my matter before the federal court is based on the denial of my motions. My motion to vacate an order on fraud based on fraud in the court was denied on the basis of res judicata, which is a doctrine that allows courts to deny motions or applications that relitigate matters. And a case that's been completed, but there's clear case law which I've cited and I can cite here today that fraud in the court, an application to vacate an order based on fraud in the court cannot be denied based on res judicata. That's a matter that goes back to the 1940s between the Third Circuit and the state of New Jersey that's not a proper basis to deny a motion for res judicata. It's also not a proper basis to bring a motion for frivolous litigation sanctions and a cross motion in a matter that's pending before the court. Because again, as an attorney, I'm wearing two hats and I'm trying to represent my client. And then I didn't have an opportunity to then assert the basis why the cross motion was improper in a separate proceeding. So as a matter of law in the state of New Jersey, both the basis for the sanctions order and the basis for the cross motion is invalid, and after I had exhausted and gone through the appellate process, in which both the appellate division and this court, and the issuing the sanctions orders, didn't even cite a single provision or rule, or case or anything. It was just an order for sanctions. It didn't say what it was based on, what the reason for it, and where the citations were. And I brought my action in federal court, asserting declaratory relief. And in that action for declaratory relief, I've sought an injunction upholding the First Amendment rights of attorneys and court proceedings such as the one that I proceeded in, asking that it be declared a constitutional due process issue, that res judicata cannot be used as a basis to deny a motion for fraud in the court. Again, I have extensive evidence, objective evidence, both on just obvious observation of the signatures, the way the proceedings were completely an opposite that every other proceeding or in general due process in court proceedings. If somebody were to design that way to get an agreement that a client, that a litigant didn't agree to before the court. This is how you'd set it up. You'd have a fraudulent signature. You wouldn't mention the terms on the record, so she wouldn't testify to them. You'd leave her with a counsel that was trying to, wasn't really representing her, was trying to withdraw from the case because and was forced to be there because there was an attorney's fee issue. And then after that, in addition to everything, we have the Judge Torak had issued a telephonic summons for interference with custody in the local municipal court, which I've asserted has no basis in the jurisdictional limits of the state of New Jersey. While he was presiding over this case and while he was presiding over this proceeding, he actually has, there's a summons out there in the local municipal court indicating it was telephonically issued by the family judge. And I was asserting in my federal complaint for declaratory injunctive relief that these court proceedings and the Office of Attorney Ethics proceedings have to be constitutional, that the court system of the state of New Jersey has to be constitutional, upholding due process and investigate fraud in the court. If the court had reviewed the evidence I submitted before it and decided that it was that it wasn't sufficient to vacate the order, then that would be one thing. But that's not what they did. They've sanctioned it. And I brought this case pro bono, as I believe that was my obligation as attorney, as a matter of ethics, to bring. So the DRB compares my case to one out in the Washington State, where an attorney supposedly, after $200,000 in fees in a family order, filed many, many motions and discovery issues, and eventually was sanctioned. This is a sanction. It's a punitive sanction against me, and for no other reason than the fact that I filed a motion, which I believe, based on some of the recent history in the case, that the Bergen County Superior Court had acknowledged that there was fraud. There was a criminal proceeding in which the indictment was dismissed in part because the records were missing. There was an acknowledgement by the assignment judge, Ms. Hall, that Dr. Dolben had been submitting improper order to show causes in different matters in the case, and some of them improperly done ex parte, and that he had acted improperly. And so it was an understanding that all I had to do was bring this motion and raise it before the court, and then possibly that the court would entertain my application. Excuse me, let me get some water. And at the time I had brought the motion, I didn't know the history of Judge Wilcox on the matter, the judge who issued the decision. He had presided not only over the family law matter later in the case after Judge Torek's decisions, he also presided over the juvenile criminal matter. And Linda Dolben was able to get an attorney to challenge the sending of the child to the Scientology indoctrination camp, which again, as a matter of law, is child abuse. You can't send a child to a school with no accreditation and no academic credentials during the school year. This judge both allowed that to happen and failed to interview the child after various requests, which finally, when the child turned 17 in the indoctrination camp, the Mojave Desert Scientology School had been closed down and he was back in New Jersey, demanded to have an interview. And finally, Judge Nizzoli, the assignment judge, instructed Judge Wilcox to do so. And then Dr. Dolben withdrew his application for custody, and the child continued to live many years after that then with the mother without any change in custody order, without any ultimate emancipation order that was ever issued in connection with the child and what those obligations may be. And instead, Judge Wilcox again issued a sanction against me and refused to address any of the issues on the record. And this is an ethics proceeding. So we have the Office of Attorney Ethics asserting that I'm violating court orders without mentioning anything about what the orders are about or how they were issued or what my basis for my, that I'm trying to challenge the orders. This hearing, quite frankly, itself is worth me having challenged these orders. I was able to put together with my client before she passed away when I filed this complaint and then amended it under the docket of the federal court in the United States District of New Jersey, a very detailed outline of all the procedural issues and violations as they occurred as against my client, including...
What is the status of the federal case?
So the status of the federal case is that all the injunctive relief and the declaratory relief I saw, including declaratory relief and on the issue of the constitutional issues of the rule of procedure that the Office of Attorney Ethics is indicating instructs lower officers of the court in ethics proceedings can't apply the Constitution since all the issues are reserved for the New Jersey Supreme Court, that they can't even comment or take into consideration.
Let's step back. Sorry, sure. You're speaking very quickly. I understand that.
I apologize. I'm trying to deal with time constraints.
Okay. So there were motions to dismiss by the Attorney General as to all the state defendants.
That's correct. Right. So is that all the...
Were they granted?
All the state defendants currently have been dismissed without prejudice based on the Younger abstention doctrine, as it applies to ethics proceedings. So I had argued later, because of the nature of the proceedings, and I want to at least at the end be able to address the public member, is that when the local ethics committee had issued their decision, they recommended dismissal, in which the presenter was seeking then admonition. The public member indicated I should receive a reprimand solely for having filed.
To the public member.
I named the public member for declaratory relief. Yes, actually, I did not. I actually did not name the public member for declaratory relief. I only named the presiding member of
did
the
you,
board.
Did you sue members of the district ethics committee?
I sued Norman Klein in his official capacity as the chief, and Robert Papa as in his official capacity as the presenter, again for declaratory injunctive relief only, which is
so that part of the case is gone.
It's been dismissed without prejudice based on the Younger abstention doctrine. Now
were given the opportunity to amend the complaint or not?
I was given an opportunity to amend the complaint only as against Frank LaRocca, the attorney that represented Dr. Dolben.
That's the other side of the case. Okay, so the only live defendants you have in the case deal with that attorney?
We'll deal with the attorney and conspiracy with the court system for to deny due process both to myself and as.
Who's left in the case? If you were to have a status conference in the case tomorrow, what defendants are left in the case?
The active defendant in the district court matter is Frank LaRocca.
The attorney who represented.
Dr. Dolben was dismissed right now without prejudice. They declined to exercise supplemental jurisdiction, so I both have the right to bring a new supplemental new case in state court or malicious prosecution if I so choose.
And I'm not talking about state court. Just my yes. Question is about the status of this federal action.
So the issue is the supplemental jurisdiction was declined. The supplemental jurisdiction over Dr. Dolben was declined on the state law cause of action for malicious prosecution. My civil rights conspiracy count remains, and I amended it as the Frank LaRocca. There's an issue with how you do that.
One defendant left, and that's Frank LaRocca.
One active defendant in the district court case. I have appellate rights.
Okay. Understand. Just bear with me. I'm asking
yes.
you about the status of the district court, the case in the district court.
Yes, Your Honor.
What's in the Third Circuit?
In the Third Circuit, there's an issue within the federal courts about having what was referred to as the collateral order doctrine, that you have a right, an absolute right of appeal from interlocutory orders prior to the completion of the proceeding, as in most cases, because of the nature of abstention issues.
What substantive issue has been, and what defendants?
All the remaining defendants, including the Chief Justice Radner, is before the Third Circuit right now.
You're challenging the dismissal based on Younger abstention with respect to all of the defendants.
Yes, Your Honor.
The state defendants, and that is pending in the Third Circuit.
It's pending in the Third Circuit. It's pending in the Third Circuit because of the procedural issues as to how the abstention would apply in this type of case. They'd asked for letters, submissions on the legal issues, and that's been pending since September to determine whether they have jurisdiction now or have to wait till the end of the case, but it's still pending.
And has the Attorney General moved to dismiss the appeal?
If I move to dismiss the appeal, that they have taken the position and a letter to the Third Circuit that it's something that shouldn't be heard until the end of the case, that it shouldn't be subject to the collateral order doctrine. But those are the. But understand that the Attorney General has, on behalf of Chief Justice Radner, is representing these courts, essentially prejudged my case and asserted that I have violated rules, that this issue with Judge Torek issuing a telephonic order was appropriate, that the lower officers of the court and Office of Attorney Ethics Proceedings are bound not to comment and make decisions based on the Constitution. And by Frank, the reason I'm doing it, and my path that I've chosen to pursue to challenge these orders is to bring the federal action for declaratory relief, and then once I have obtained that relief, then go back to the state court proceeding and vacate the orders once I have a judgment in federal court asserting that res judicata is not a proper basis to deny a motion, that the due process has to be followed, that the ethics rules as they are applied to me, and specifically, again, this issue about the openly challenging the validity of an order has never been ruled on in the state of New Jersey. It's one of first impression, the rights of First Amendment, the rights of attorneys needs to be ruled on first.
Where it stands now in the Third Circuit is there's an exchange of letters about the Younger abstention issue and whether or not that should be heard collateral as part of the collateral order doctrine
yes,
immediately or whether it should be heard at the end of the case.
That's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct. I'm sorry. I took so long to get there.
Can you clarify one additional point with respect to my being named as a defendant in the federal matter? Does that stem from the entry of an order on behalf of this court?
It stems both from the order on behalf of this court and the fact that Your Honor is the Chief Justice of the state of New Jersey as to these, both the rules of court that I'm challenging and ethics proceedings as being constitutional, and that as the judge in official capacity, I'm asserting that as they've been applied to me and other attorneys, that the Office of Attorney Ethics as applies to the Middlesex County case from the early 1980s on ethics rules and how you challenge constitutional issues it's not being followed, yes, I would have had the right to bring an interlocutory application, but it doesn't relieve and indicate that lower officers of the court in ethics proceedings, including Mr. Klein and the officers in the DRB, can't comment or take the Constitution into consideration. And that's the position, unbelievably, I think, that the Office of Attorney Ethics has taken, that the officers, they not only have to reserve the decision, but they actually have to reserve their opinions on the issue. So the DRB presiding judge did issue an opinion addressing some of the constitutional issues, and is the only one that did that. And I'm arguing it didn't take into consideration properly the constitutional issues, didn't address them properly. And the reason for the Younger abstention issue is that those declaratory judgment issues that I'm seeking to use them to turn based on those policies and then turn around to file the motion to vacate the order in state court is something that I would have to obtain. And by it being dismissed, it's actually delayed my ability to do that. And the Attorney General, acting on behalf of this court, has got my case and dismissed without prejudice because it's indicating that this forum, in which I did not seek some kind of stay of this proceeding, in part because I'm hoping that the court's going to take time to review what I've put together and what I did on behalf of my client. To indicate all the fraud that occurred, the documentation of child abuse that occurred in the case that wouldn't have happened if the court had followed proper procedure and orders, and that this child, now an adult, that was clearly affected by, that those things will be reviewed by the court and they'll take it into consideration and look beyond the order that, you know, the issue that hasn't been discussed at all, again, is collateral estoppel, as it was indicated in the prior case. Collateral estoppel in ethics proceedings, there's a different standard of proof here, and as a fine frivolous litigation application has got to be based on preponderance of the evidence. We're in a clear and convincing argument, a standard of proof, and I've argued that I shouldn't be entitled to a new proceeding to look beyond just the letter of the order. That basically the Office of Attorney Ethics has taken a position that no matter how onerous or unconstitutional or fraudulent, that if, as a matter of ethics, if I refuse to abide by it, that somehow I'm the one that's I should be sanctioned in an ethics proceeding. There's no related state court proceedings trying to enforce the orders to which I would challenge if a motion to enforce
litigation. If the sanctions were paid, Mr. Rossellini, and ultimately you were to prevail in your federal declaratory judgment action and the orders were vacated, you get your money back. Correct?
I don't want, but the thing is, I don't know if the federal court, by both refusing to pay it, I keep it an active case in controversy under the Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution. Yeah,
but you're taking the position here that there are orders for sanctions that you don't have to pay them because you are moving in federal court. You've filed an action to get them vacated. Okay. And that's the position you're taking.
Well, I'm seeking relief in the federal courts, which I then intend to use to vacate the orders in state court. I can't.
Your ultimate goal, as I understand you've explained it today, is to get those orders vacated.
Yes, Your Honor. And
sometimes orders are vacated by the very courts that enter them in the first place, or by another court. Correct? It happens a lot.
Yes.
And if we're talking about here, a payment of sanctions that can be undone.
Well, but I don't have it by refusing as a matter of ethics to pay what I'm asserting is an invalid and constitutional order. The ethics rules allow for it because that's why there's a provision in there. And in addition, the federal court may not hear my case. I already have the Attorney General arguing that there's no case in controversy that's active in that case.
I'm not suggesting the federal court is going to give you that relief.
Oh, but they might not even hear the case if I don't stand here and if they would say there's no active controversy if I paid it. They say, well, I'm challenging it, but this is a moot point because the issue is closed and I've satisfied the judgment.
So is that the basis for your refusal to pay, and that is that you don't want the federal court to find no active case or controversy because the payment's been made?
That's only part of it, absolutely. That's one of the reasons that I'm refusing. It's both as an ethical issue that I believe as a matter of ethics that I shouldn't be required to pay an unconstitutional order that is really designed to chill not only my speech, but the speech of any attorney who advocates on behalf of a client in the state of New Jersey and any litigant in the state of New Jersey that's simply trying to seek fairness and ask the court to investigate a fraud. And if they're sanctioned, then they're required, especially in a situation where I'm acting pro bono in a one-time motion without having received any attorney's fees whatsoever. And I had no personal stake in the matter. I haven't sought any help outside of the court system that I've made. I started to seek and pursue amicus briefs, and I did get one from the Family Civil Liberties Union in the state of New Jersey. Just recently submitted something, and certainly, if this court does decide to suspend me, it'll be cause major irreparable harm to my clients and the advocacy, including many of the civil rights actions that I have on behalf of clients involving injunctive and declaratory relief for the state and the Jersey court system, particularly in the family part.
But just so I understand.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm having trouble following some of this, but sanctions are imposed upon you as the attorney representing this now deceased plaintiff.
Yes.
And they were imposed upon you because in 2006 there was a purported settlement agreement regarding a divorce proceeding. And then in 2016, I guess growing out of that or property that was exchanged in connection with that, there was a foreclosure proceeding against your client.
Yes.
And you represented her pro bono in that proceeding and looked behind the foreclosure at this settlement agreement that she allegedly, purportedly entered into and the court approved and decided that was a forgery. And so you tried to challenge the foreclosure and all of the preceding events by saying this was a forgery, and because it was a forgery, my client has certain rights and you can't foreclose and you can't deprive her of these property rights and other rights, correct? And that's what led to the sanctions.
That's what led to the sanctions.
So wait a minute. So yes. You brought that proceeding, and the court reviewed it, the trial court, and reviewed it and decided that was a frivolous endeavor, that there was really no support for it, and because it was frivolous, they imposed sanctions on you for bringing that proceeding to open up the prior 10-year-old or so divorce and the foreclosure, correct?
That
started the ball rolling.
Yes, I didn't ask for foreclosure relief in that case. I asked them to look at orders which included my client had permanent alimony.
That's what got it all going. And
yes.
So by your challenging that 10-year-old divorce settlement agreement, sanctions were imposed on you because the court concluded those were frivolous proceedings.
Yes.
And that's why we're here today.
Yes.
And that's the only reason we're here today.
Well, it's the only reason you're here today because our complaint has been...
I get it, but that's why we're here today.
Yes.
So whatever happens in the federal court happens in the federal court. But we're here to talk about that underlying disciplinary proceeding arising from sanctions that were imposed on you in that attempt to overturn a 10-year-old divorce proceeding.
Well, what I'm seeking in the federal court is to declare that the underlying policies, including the denial...
I got you. They'll figure that out. We won't.
That's the very issue that I'm asking the court to look...
I get you.
To look beyond the sanction order and to say that this is an order we have to enforce. So what happened in that order? How did that...
Wait until the federal court action is done?
Well,
that's one avenue.
Well, one avenue is that...
Practice until that happens.
Let me practice. Stay. Certainly, if there are any sanctions or issues, they'll allow it to stay, because I intend certainly to, I would then petition.
You're speaking so fast.
I'm sorry.
I'm having trouble understanding.
I would then petition to. If there is a sanction order issued of any kind, I would also exercise my appellate rights with the U.S. Supreme Court, and I would ask for there to be a stay of that sanction.
So but if you lose on the collateral order, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
I'm done.
I'm sorry.
I just had one question. You may not have explored this. In terms of the federal district court's lack of jurisdiction under Younger,
yes,
would the court be able to assume jurisdiction if the sanctions were paid in escrow?
It's possible. I don't know the answer to that. Nobody, I mean, that has not been proposed by the other side. There wasn't, or anybody, any of the litigants. So that's certainly one possible resolution. If monies were placed in escrow that weren't turned over while the matter was pending, and that it was still an active case in controversy, certainly that would be something I'd be willing to potentially agree to as part of a resolution of that issue. But nobody, that's never been offered to me. It's never been discussed. They indicate I have to, that isn't, again, there's no enforcement proceedings in state court. I have an ethics proceeding in which they're using the ethics rules to try to enforce a judgment, which is ultimately challenging in litigation. And if I were to lose my federal court action, then I would, as I'd asserted in the Disciplinary Review Board, I believe then I have exhausted everything that I could do, and even if I would still argue that it's unconstitutional, I would then be obligated under the ethical rules I believe to pay it.
Can you help us on the timeline? Cert was denied by this court in December of 2017.
Yes.
When did you come back with a motion for reconsideration, if you recall?
Within 20 days after I received the order, and I filed a motion for rehearing with the court.
I understand the motion was denied January of 2019. When did you go to federal court?
I went to federal court in November of 2020.
Why did you wait nearly 2 years?
First of all, I received the ethics proceeding papers actually before I received the order from this court denying my petition for rehearings. And I had the right certainly to bring those actions within the statute of limitations. And my client was hoping to resolve the underlying issues with Dr. Dolben. I didn't want to interfere with her efforts and whatever she was going to try to do within the state court system to possibly resolve it by bringing my own personal action addressing the issues. And when I went before the disciplinary, ethics committee, local committee, and we had the two, so I still have the right to bring it, and I will be filing it within the statute of limitations, the 2 years on the federal issue, and then in connection with the ethics proceedings with respect to the procedural issues that were raised. And if the matter had been resolved by my client, remember, the sanctions were issued against me as the attorney because we had an indigent client and an indigent party, and the court indicated that they were going to sanction the attorney and did it based on an application of re judicata without really discussing the merits.
Is that what the trial court said, that it was sanctioning you because the attorney, because the client didn't have money, or it was a frivolous action, as they...
There was a previous order entered, and there was one other motion filed by an attorney in which sanctions weren't issued in the intervening time frame.
Slow down.
I'm sorry. There was a previous order entered in the family court part that indicated that if another motion was filed that the court deemed frivolous, that they were going to sanction the attorney because the party didn't have money and was indigent. And then there was one other motion filed after that was determined not to be frivolous. When I filed my motion, it was determined to be frivolous based on the doctrine of re judicata, and then they're going to enforce this previous order because the attorneys were warned that they would be sanctioned personally because the client no longer had any money. And the reason why she didn't have any money, if she was financially incapable, was because of the orders that I was seeking to vacate. She was disabled and was not able to continue her alimony because of what happened in that case.
What are you asking us to do today? Are you asking us to wait until all matters are resolved up the ladder through the federal system?
Yes, Your Honor, because I believe that those cases would potentially resolve the litigation, either vacating the order or me obtaining a judgment against the parties by which that order could be offset, and I would have the opportunity to pursue the litigation and resolve the issue. On the other side, if the court
to be clear,
yes,
up through a ruling on the merits by the Supreme Court potentially, or the denial of certification by the Supreme Court.
Correct. Yes. Absolutely. Yes.
And if you are unsuccessful on the collateral order doctrine, the issue then waits to the end of the case.
It waits to the end of the case.
What does that mean as a practical matter in that case? You have state defendants are out, right? You have this action against the attorney. Where is that? What in terms of procedurally?
An answer has been filed. The issue in federal court is when you file an amended complaint, how you do it pleading wise. So I amended the complaint as the Frank LaRocca, but I also included all the previous counts. And that's the way, in order to preserve the issues for appeal, that's the way you have to do it. There are a lot of federal courts that say you...
But there's no obligation on the part of dismissed parties to answer.
That's my understanding, correct, but that's why they wrote a letter to the, asking for instruction, and that issue is pending.
Right, so there, but that's the beginning. That's pleadings. We're yes. at the beginning of that case, right?
We're at the beginning of that case, unfortunately, yes. there could be a discovery conference, hopefully, that will come up, and then I'll be able to litigate the matter with Frank Foraca, and then potentially I have the right to bring a supplemental, a state court proceeding against Dr. Dolben, which I may have to do, but that's not how I want to proceed. I'm hoping to resolve the case in the federal court matter, either on appeal.
We've spent a good deal of time on this so far.
Yes, I appreciate it very much.
Is there anything else that you need to raise? We're about three quarters of an hour now.
I very much appreciate it. Well, I think it's important, again, the retaliatory aspect of the suspension, how we got to this level involving the public member. The public member was on the advisory board of Valley National Bank, and I raised that as an issue for him to recuse himself because I have active litigation involving an individual by the name of Anthony Dottilio against Valley National Bank that goes to the highest levels of the bank and goes back to the time when this individual was on the advisory board, which is related to my case because the Genova Burns law firm had an attorney also on the advisory board then that because of a conflict of interest that the bank referred the case to another attorney.
You know how the case got here, don't we?
Well, but that aspect of it, I'm not sure that the court is aware of.
We know how it got here.
Well, it got here, but it gets to...
I'm not meaning to ask another question. I just...
Yeah, I understand.
Move it along.
Well, the level of sanction that we're here is solely because of my federal lawsuit. The public member asserted that solely because I filed a federal lawsuit, then regardless of the merits, that I should receive a reprimand. So at the committee level, an admonishment was sought. Then it was asserted by the local, by the public member that I should receive a reprimand, refuse to recuse himself solely because of my constitutional right to assert a federal cause of complaint. So that matter is...
All of the orders against you were brought before the ethics proceedings began. No, the
yes.
orders...
Correct, right. But the seeking of the constant increased sanctions that now we're at the suspension level, all happened after I filed my federal complaint. So initially they were seeking admonition. That was what the presenter was seeking. Then I filed my federal complaint, and then the public member said I should receive a reprimand solely for having filed that application. And because I'm continuing the litigation, continuing to pursue it, then the Office of Attorney Ethics said that I should receive a censure. And then the Office of Attorney Ethics found that the Disciplinary Review Board found for suspension, and then that's the position that's been adopted by the Office of Attorney Ethics. So we have cases recently where an attorney was suspended for 3 months because they had, were found guilty and pleaded guilty to terroristic threats. We have an attorney who wasn't suspended, he was read pretrial intervention on for unlawful
possession. Who wants to address the merits today?
I don't want to address the merits, but if the issue of the length of sanctions is before the court,
all right.
I just want to briefly address it.
Why don't you address it briefly?
Again, as I indicated before, there's no precedent in the state of New Jersey, and the attorney that represented Dr. Dolben that filed the motion to vacate the order is an individual by the name of Jared Lands, who received censure from this court because he was indicted for conspiracy to commit theft by deception with his client, and he wasn't suspended. So I'm here solely because I'm challenging a court order that I'm litigating. I'm taking the appropriate avenues to challenge it, exercising my First Amendment rights, and the sanctions and the level of sanction. There's no explanation as to the basis for it in any of the papers that the Office of Attorney Ethics has submitted, and really in the DRB decision either. I'm asking, I'm hoping that the court, I appreciate the time that the court has spent on this, and I hope I've been up for the task. I apologize that I do often, unfortunately, speak fast and not always as articulate as I'd like to be. I think I'm a better writer than I am a speaker. But I hope that the court takes into consideration that they review what I presented, they review the exhibits, they review the complaint and the amended complaint, and they'll find that there were serious issues before the court, and that I wouldn't be here today, and the court wouldn't be reviewing it, if not for the fact that I've taken what I believe to be an ethical and a constitutional position to refuse these orders, and I think that...
Do you concede that if the federal court does not vacate these orders, that you have the obligation to pay the sanctions?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it your intention, if that were to happen, while this proceeding is still pending, to pay what is owed under those orders?
I believe that I would have no other legal recourse than it would only be my opinion.
It was a little
yes.
different.
Oh, yes.
Is it your intention to pay at that point if that occurs?
Yes, Your Honor.
Other questions, anyone?
Thank you. Well, thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate all your time and the time of the court and the time of everyone involved.
McGinty, anything to add about where we find those documents, or is that what you were about to tell us as well? The transcript and the underlying agreement. Please come to the center. Thank you.
Chief Justice, I would like by letter to be able to submit that.
Where the documents in the...
Yes. Yes. There's a case box. So, well, yes.
Take your letter. The clerk
there's
the
quite
court.
A lot.
Clerk and, of the court will be in touch. Good.
And also, Chief Justice, do you also want the summary of what's going on in the federal case?
Let us get back to you on that through the clerk of the court.
Thank you.
Thank you.